That working right.
Well, it seems to be working okay because it's receiving the signal.
Okay.
And I know we have power, so. So now in 1944, you move on to the University of Illinois as assistant professor of chemistry.
Right.
Was this your first experience with teaching?
Except for being a TA.
Okay.
I did a little bit of that, and then as I said, I helped teach that course on explosives.
Right, okay. Now, what courses were you responsible for at Illinois?
Anyway, it was essentially physical chemistry that the juniors take first year
sure.
Of physical chemistry.
Yeah. Wow, okay. What book did you use, just out of curiosity?
I'm not sure that I remember. I know that when I was in college, we used Farrington Daniels.
Oh, sure.
And,
yes.
Oh, we used a book authored by Rodebush, who was the head of physical chemistry at Illinois.
Okay. All right. And how did you like teaching?
I love it. I miss that when I retired. I missed that because I'm enough of a ham to enjoy it. What I didn't miss was making two things, making up exams and writing research proposals.
Yeah.
We put our examinations at Pitt in the library so that all students would have access to them. That put the old exams.
Yes.
And that meant that I had to make new questions all the time.
Right.
And I don't like questions where all they do is just substitute a different number in an equation. I wanted questions that made them think a little bit. And that got very hard
Sure. Toward
the end.
Oh, yeah. But you were by this time ready to make a career in academe.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And did you start a research program there?
I started
Illinois?
In Illinois.
Mm-hmm. You did.
There had been a man named Buswell. Buswell and Rodebush did the early work on the near infrared, and they had some equipment, mostly for near infrared. So I was starting to go through that and organize it. And then Porcanelmer commercial instrument became available. And Speed Marvel and Roger Adams were consulting for companies like DuPont, and they saw these instruments down there and what they could do. So they got an early model, and they gave it to me and asked me to run a service laboratory. So we hired a lady that had some experience with company in Park Davis in Kalamazoo. Her husband had come to Illinois to do graduate work. They had both worked at the Park Davis laboratory. The name was Johnson. Her name was Agatha. And she had done group frequency work there. So she brought it was just a godsend. She brought a wealth of knowledge and know-how. So she would run spectra for the organic chemists that needed it and would help interpret it, and I would look over her shoulder, and that's the way I got into that.
Do you remember what those instruments were? Were they
which models?
Early Porcanelmer, you said?
The Porcanelmer 12B.
Okay.
Their first one was 12A, and then what was the difference? I think we started with a 12A, and then they added a drive mechanism, and that made it 12B. There was some modest change.
Mm-hmm.
And then they introduced Max Liston's breaker amplifier, which chopped the radiation, and the detector was tuned to
That's
that.
Right. Yeah.
So that was a tremendous step forward. And then we got a strip chart recorder. Boy, was that a big advance.
Oh, sure.
There were Leeds and Northrop, and there was, I think there, and there was a Speedamax. It was Brown, I think, Brown instrument. But That was such a tremendous advantage to get a written record out.
Oh, sure. Did you receive support and assistance from the senior faculty at Illinois? Because you were just starting off.
I was just starting. Not very much. In fact, they were almost distracted me. There was a big drive to all through the university to improve the teaching by, I don't remember now how they're going to do it, but some of the senior chemistry faculty wanted me to take this on for the chem department, and in that case I would have been marked as an instructor, a teacher, rather than a researcher, and I'm sure I wouldn't have done very well in the sense of advancement.
Right.
But something happened, and that went by the boards, and so I never heard any more about it. Thank goodness.
Well, we're still debating that today. What do you have any thoughts about education today? How students are being taught, or do you, in college especially?
I've been away for 30 years, John.
Sure.
I really don't. I have strong feelings about grade school teaching. I think it's a disaster.
Yeah.
And I think that what we need are better teachers, teachers who have majors in subjects rather than majors in education. I remember I had a grad student one time who had been an education major. Then he was drafted and was in Vietnam for a number of years and then came back and decided to go to graduate school in chemistry. He told me the only thing he learned in the education courses was that you should erase the blackboard up and down rather than horizontally so the chuck dust would go in the tray at the bottom.
That's pretty good. So in 1948, you moved on to the Mellon Institute for Industrial Research as head of the spectroscopy division. How did that come about?
Well, it's another example of it's who you know, not what you know. There was an X-ray crystallographer at Minnesota named Harold Klug, whom we knew socially. I knew him at the university. We'd have lunch together and that sort of thing. But they were a member of the dance club, and we were also, and we used to go to those affairs. He left and went to Mellon Institute to set up a department of chemical physics after the war. There were all these new instruments becoming available, and the people at Mellon wanted to have them available, accessible, but they didn't want to bother learning how to use them. So they decided to set up a department of chemical physics, which would have X-ray crystallography and spectroscopy and electron diffraction. And he was hired to be the head of it. And he had a man as a spectroscopist who was already working at Mellon. But he decided to change jobs. So Harold Klug was looking around for somebody, and he remembered me, wrote and asked me if I'd be interested. Well, I really wasn't. Pittsburgh had a terrible reputation in those days. But I said I would come for an interview. And I was really impressed, and I was impressed because my predecessor, this man Marston, had acquired two important instruments, the first Baird double beam infrared and the first Cary visible UV recording instrument, serial number one in both cases. And our place was just a mecca for people that wanted to see these before they bought one. The steady stream of people coming through to look at them.
Wow.
Well, Mellon was a nice place. It's a wonderful building, and I was really taken with it. My wife had taken Bruce was a little baby then, she had gone to Baltimore to visit her folks while I was interviewing in Pittsburgh. So I was concerned whether she'd like it, and the Mellon people said, well, we'd be glad to pay her way up here so she could look it over. So she came up while I was still there and looked it over, and they showed her around town a little bit, and so we decided to go. Now there's an interesting prelogue to that. On my way to Baltimore, one of the early trips, I was riding the B&O, which went through Pittsburgh, and we pulled in and stopped at the station, and it was right underneath one of the inclines, funiculars. I'd never seen one before, so I sat and watched, and I quickly figured out how it worked. And I said to myself, and I remember this very distinctly, Foyle, you'd never catch me living in a place where they have to use something like that to get around. 10 years later, there I was.
Was that the old Pittsburgh and Lake Erie station?
Exactly.
Right on the river?
It was.
I visited there a few years ago because I'm a rail fan and I love old railroad stations.
Bruce thought you were.
Yeah. And what a magnificent station.
Oh, yeah.
That is, even today, it's a restaurant.
Yeah.
We took the funicular.
Yes, the incline is still there, the Duquesne incline.
Yeah. The Mellon, that was not a university at the time. It was strictly
no.
a research.
It was a
they were doing research for the neighboring industry. Is that?
It was set up to show companies the value of research. It's the third oldest industrial research operation in the U.S. It was preceded by the GE Labs, and I don't remember what the other one was.
Wow.
Interesting background. There was a man in Kansas who wrote a book saying that industry, the research would really be of value to industry, but industry was reluctant to do it because they didn't know anything about it.
Right.
And he therefore proposed that there be a department set up in a university where they would have people come from industry, work for, say, at least a year on some project of theirs. They might be to introduce students to this work. The findings would be the property of the company. The company would find this was very worthwhile, mm-hmm. and whether we'd be willing to set up their own research laboratories. Andrew Mellon had, he was trying to learn, I think it was French, and he had a person come in to teach him. And this person somehow had that book, don't ask me how, and he loaned it to Andrew Mellon, and Andrew read it, and he thought that it was a great idea, and he convinced his brother to go in, and so they set up Mellon Institute as a department of the University of Pittsburgh, and it ran that way. It was wildly successful. In fact, it became too big and too much for a university, so they set it up as a separate organization.
I didn't know that.
And then ultimately gave it its own building.
What was it like to live in Pittsburgh at that time with the serious air pollution? In October 48, there was the infamous Donora smog.
Yeah, that was the only smog we saw. We moved there in July of 48, and I remember the Donora smog very well, but we never saw any after that because they had put in regulations right after the war to burn treated coal, and then it turned out that natural gas was brought to the city, and almost everybody converted to that.
Oh, okay.
Also, steam locomotives were replaced by diesels.
That's right.
And on the river, diesel engines became used. So that all these things came together. They set up required controls for the smoke, and so the city improved dramatically, and I never saw it in the old dirty days. It really used to be fierce.
Yeah.
If a man was going to a fair in the evenings, he'd take a white shirt to work and it changed into that before going to the fair, because the one he was wearing would be dirty.
Now, was the steel industry in full production at that time?
Yeah, when I was there.
And was that contributing to the pollution?
Well, it certainly did before these rules went into effect.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. That must have been a big change from Illinois and academe for you to be at the Mellon.
Yes, but you know, I just took it, never thought anything about it. It was different.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of independence at Mellon. That was, the arrangement was that we would work half-time for other people in the Institute on a charge, hourly charge basis, and then half-time on our own work. And the young people were doing graduate work. They were graduate students at Pitt, but I was directing their research. And I also, after a few years, started teaching one course at Pitt,
right,
which taught every year. So it wasn't as big a change as it might seem.
What, do you remember the instrumentation that was available there at Mellon? It must have been lot of state-of-the-art.
Already described the Baird number one and the Carey number one.
Right.
And then we didn't have any trouble getting equipment when better instruments came out. We got the series. We had the Beckman IR-4 and the Beckman IR-7 and the Beckman IR-11, which was the far infrared. And later, Bill Fately succeeded me after I moved to Pitt, and he got one of the first Fourier transform instruments. We got a Carey Raman instrument when they came out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty good that way.
In 1952, you wrote a 41-page paper on infrared spectra of inorganic ions with C.H. Wilkins. That must have been a monumental undertaking.
It was. And
especially inorganic, a lot of people think IR organic.
That's one reason it was so popular. No doubt, there were thousands of copies of that were made and given out. And Chuck Wilkins was one of the young people. He wasn't working for a degree, it was just a job for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran zillions of samples. For example, we went through the stock room at Mellon, and I went up to the stock room at Pitt and got little samples from all
of them. Just ran everything, huh?
Yeah, right now. Because we didn't know what we were going to find. And it turned out that the carbonate ion is like a molecule, phosphate ion is a tetrahedral molecule.
Yeah.
And
I was going to ask how you joined the University of Pittsburgh, but Mellon, I can see how that happened now, because you were working with Mellon and they were already associated with
and
Pitt.
Mellon had close ties with Pitt. We also went over and ate lunches at the faculty club. That was the closest good place to eat. So I got to know a lot of the faculty over there just on a social basis.
And then you gradually became, assistant professor and then full professor at Pitt.
Well, I was really an adjunct. In 1950, they had a man on the faculty who was to teach quantum mechanics, and he committed suicide. So they didn't have anybody, and they came over to the head of Mellon Institute and asked if they could ask me to do it, and he said sure. So they did, and I did it. I wasn't paid anything, as I remember, to fill in. And then after that was done, they got somebody to do it, but they asked me if I'd teach a spectroscopy course. And that was really quite an undertaking because we had a laboratory with it. And this was an evening course because I could get away then. So that went on for a good many years.
You were professor of chemistry, well, from 67 to 81, yeah. You were professor of chemistry and head of the spectroscopy laboratory. Was that unusual in those days to be both a professor and head of a laboratory?
Yeah, well, and head of the laboratory was just a sales pitch to help sell me on the job. And I was made what they called a university professor, which meant I could get students from any department. And I did have one or two from physics. They were actually students who wanted to major in physics but wanted to do molecular spectroscopy. Mm-hmm.
I think it was around this time that you wrote a series of papers with W.G.
Fately,
using the far infrared.
Yeah.
What information, I'm not that familiar with the far infrared, what information did that give you?
Far infrared are low frequencies. Put them in wave numbers, it's anything below 200 wave numbers. And there are some special kinds of vibrations that have these low frequencies. A simple one is a torsion in around a single bond. And they're interesting because they measure the height of the potential barrier for that twist.
Uh-huh.
Ring molecules have puckering vibrations where the ring goes like this, and those have low frequencies. So there are, then of course, if you have a molecule with heavy atoms, like bromine or uranium or covalently bonded uranium or any heavy metal, mercury, there will be low frequency vibrations. Mm. So the far infrared gives you access to that.
Now, was that a different instrument or the
yes.
same instrument?
It was a different instrument because you had to use a different detector. If you were using a grating, it had to be a coarser grating. And then the detector was what was called a Golay detector, not a thermocouple. The energy is in these low frequencies is very low.
Yeah. Right.
So we built our first far infrared instrument.
Wow.
It was hand built. Later we had a commercial one.
Well, it's apparent that you love teaching. Now you're back in teaching at Pitt, directing research, and you're
right.
an active researcher. Do you have an overall philosophy of education?
No, I don't think so, except that I thought it shouldn't be too easy. I think that not everybody should go to university or college. I think that we have lots of needs for good technical people like electricians and plumbers and roofers, carpenters and so on, and they don't need to spend the money and time to get a college education.
Hmm.
And for the people that are there, I thought it ought to be a rigorous experience.
What is, moving on to today, what is the current status of infrared and Raman spectroscopy?
Raman, again, I'm not really with it.
Sure.
But I do read a journal. Raman is flourishing very, it's amazing to me. In fact, before I retired, it became as easy to get a Raman spectrum as an infrared, which just floored me. I don't, anything beyond my wildest expectations. And Raman has continued to go very well. Infrared, I think, has leveled off.
Mm.
I can foresee a change that might make a tremendous difference in infrared, and that is if we got tunable lasers. so you could get rid of the dispersing element prism or grating or interference plates. Just tune the grating, have lots of power. That would really be a big boost for infrared. But I think at present there aren't many exciting things coming in. That's not quite totally true. There are array detectors now, so you can get the spectrum of an area of a, say, a crystalline sample. Let's say a mineral, a rock that you get up, which has a number of different substances, you can get the spectrum of the whole array. So that's of interest to some people.
Well, the Fourier transform was certainly a major advance.
It was a major change.
Wow.
Oh, I tell you, I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
I remember
the interesting thing is that since essentially going back to the single beam instrument again, you compare the sample
exactly.
and the reference spectra.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's gone full cycle from the single to the double, now back to the single beam instrument. You remained as an adjunct senior fellow with Mellon even after it joined with the Carnegie Institute of Technology to form the Carnegie Mellon University. I believe that was 1967. How did these two institutions come together?
Well, the Mellons had backed Mellon Institute, and they wanted to get that off their shoulders. And so what do you do with an operation like that? Well, one obviously attractive idea is to fold it into a university. And the logical thing would have been to put it in with Pitt, but the Mellons and the president of Pitt at the time, a man named Litchfield, were on the outs. And so they wouldn't do that. So the other leading university was Carnegie Tech. Mm-hmm. And so they decided to merge the two and make Carnegie Mellon University.
Mm-hmm. To what extent was the chemistry department at Pitt involved in research at the Mellon Institute and local industries, for example?
Not much. They were pretty independent. They worked together. I don't mean in that sense, but they didn't have much influence on what one did on what the other one did.
Okay. Now, I didn't know about your long-term involvement with the MIT Bowdoin College.
Oh.
Summer courses in infrared spectroscopy. How did that start?
In the late 40s, the instrument firms got concerned that there weren't going to be enough people that knew how to use their instruments. So I could see their market being limited by that fact. So both Perkin-Elmer and Baird independently came to Dick Lord and asked him if he'd run a short summer course to train people in infrared, how to get spectra and what to do with it once they did. And so he agreed to start such a course, and he asked me if I'd help him. And I was a logical choice since I was working in the field from the industrial side. And so we started doing that, and I remember going down to Boston 2 or 3 weeks before the course started, and we whipped together things there. We had had correspondence, but we actually got down to the nitty-gritty then. So the first year, it was just 1 week, if I remember rightly, and it was a roaring success. So the second year, we gave the same week twice. We just duplicated it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was so much material that we decided to make it 2 weeks on two different aspects. The first week would be on how to run the instruments, how they operated, how to prepare samples, and all the experimental aspects.
Yes.
And the second week would be on interpretation of the spectrum.
Right.
So that was a big success. So yeah, it just went from there.
And that continued for how many years?
I stayed with it for 53 years. Okay. And it's still running, although it's limping at this stage. Hmm. They've given up the second week.
Now there's a website, I just out of curiosity looked up on Alibris, your book, which you used in that course, Course Notes on the Interpretation of Infrared and Raman Spectra.
Yeah.
And you know, collector's editions are selling for $288.
What?
Yes. Currently, right now, on the web.
Alibris. I don't think they're selling.
Well, that's what they're for sale for.
Gosh.
So that's a real collector's item.
There's an interesting story about that. We didn't write this till we finished at the end of my stay, actually. And I resisted writing anything for a long time because I said if we write it, we're going to be reluctant to change. And we'd want to keep modifying. The course had changed remarkably over the years.
Yeah.
But the... there was an invitation from China to give the course there, and they insisted on having a written text. It turned out they translated it in Chinese.
Oh, sure.
So we were forced to write it down at that stage. And so then we refined it each year, and finally, as I approached the end of my thing, we put it in book form, three of us, Dana Mayo and Bob Hanna and I.
Hmm. And I know
there's another interesting thing. This is about time new methods of printing were coming in, electronic setting up and so on. So the book came out and it had some terrible misprints where we had some figures with arrows, there might be boxes, and they got the experiments all fouled up too. And it was had to do with that, I think. And so the publisher, it was Wiley, we were really irked because we checked against what we sent in, and what we sent in was correct. So they said they wanted to give out a little correction with each copy, a little pamphlet.
Yeah, sure.
I said, that is ridiculous. Spend hours transferring the information. I said, if you're going to do that, I want to statement at the beginning saying that this was the fault of the publisher or printer, the material as received by the authors was perfectly correct. So they turned around and printed the thing over again and did it right.
Oh wow, that was good.
But it never sold very many copies.
Do you still have a copy?
I have a copy, yeah. I have a copy of each version then. I may show you the corrected, the erroneous one.
I would like to see that. Now, for many years, you were part of the ACS Speakers Bureau. I'm sure you don't remember this, but I heard your talk, and it's probably the first time I met you in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Oh, did you?
Was it at St. Peter's, or it was probably a meeting of the Hudson Bergen section of the ACS, New York section. And you gave your wonderful talk, Great Mistakes in Science. And how did you come up with that concept of, and how did you do the research for that talk?
Well, I think all my career I've tended to collect interesting stories and that sort of thing. I was invited to give a talk at the Clarion. What is now Clarion University, it used to be Teachers College, which is just north of Pittsburgh. It's part of the Pennsylvania state system. And it was to be on some kind of an award ceremony or something where there would be a wives present. And so my usual technical talk wouldn't have been appropriate. And I got to wondering what I could talk about, and I hit on that idea. And so I've just been gathering stories together. I still do. The pile is still active, and I drop things in every now and then.
That's wonderful.
I really wish I had published it, and I probably never will now. It's so big now to do it and to check all the facts and to get the citations would be a tremendous job.
Yeah. Wow.
I've given it, 150 times, I think.
Absolutely.
That's why I got my money's worth out
Absolutely.
Of it.
Amazing. Well, I'm going to take a little break here.
Sure. Do you want to use the restroom?